From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland in the Temescal neighborhood.
Jack London Square.
Fruitvale.
Adams Point.
Grand Lake neighborhood.
Coming up, local public health officials debate the benefits of e-cigarettes.
It works great. It's been the best device for quitting smoking.
And their dangers.
You need to know something about the dose of nicotine that you're getting, and who knows?
Then we'll hear from author Michael Pollan on why some doctors are giving cancer patients psychedelic drugs.
The suspense is, how does he die? Does he die in a better way than he would have if he hadn't taken this drug? And the answer clearly for him was yes.
And we'll get experimental with saxophonist Philip Greenleaf.
Yeah, some people call it noise, but it's really just a more complex web of frequencies that are happening.
Sax, drugs, and rock and roll. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. You've probably seen e-cigarettes around. Maybe it's someone who looks like they're chewing on a pen or having a smoke in a restaurant or a bar. In reality, they're vaping, inhaling and exhaling a vapor of heated nicotine and flavoring. Vapers say e-cigarettes keep them away from more dangerous tobacco products. Public health officials say vaping normalizes nicotine use, exposes users to unknown harms, and introduces kids to potential addiction. A CDC report released this month found middle and high school students' use of vaporizers tripled in just a year. That's why many public health officials want to ban vaping in public spaces statewide. So, no vaping in restaurants, bars, or on sidewalks near doorways. Here in the Bay Area, some bans are already in place in San Francisco and some parts of Santa Clara County. Other cities have yet to take up the issue. Reporter Leslie Griffey went to San Jose to discover why people vape and what worries public health officials about this growing trend.
Natasha Ernst sits on the busy patio of a public market in San Jose, sipping a beer. Every so often, she pulls out what looks like a small cigarette and takes a puff of nicotine, legally. If she was smoking a cigarette, she'd almost certainly be asked to leave. The market could face a code violation. But Ernst isn't a smoker anymore.
In college, I lived in Paris, and that's where I started smoking.
The habit lasted for years. It was part of a romanticized idea of what it meant to be a writer living abroad.
I had a bit of a Hemingway complex, let's say, and spent a lot of time in brasserie thinking about the great American novels that I would write. But it developed into a habit because it's nicotine.
Nicotine is a highly addictive neurotoxin, a substance as hard to kick as heroin. So Ernst decided to give up the cigarettes but keep the nicotine. She tried lots of different options, gums and lozenges, but nothing worked. Enter vaping.
It works great. It's been the best device for quitting smoking. I haven't smoked a cigarette in over 2.5 years.
That argument doesn't sit right with Sarah Cody. She's Santa Clara County's health officer and leading public health advocate, sort of a surgeon general for the South Bay.
I really can't follow the logic why it's okay then to introduce nicotine addiction in another way. It really doesn't make sense.
Cody's leading the county's charge against expanding nicotine addiction.
If you want a smoking cessation help, you need to know something about the dose of nicotine that you're getting, and who knows what you're getting in an e-cigarette.
Unlike other smoking cessation tools, e-cigarettes aren't currently regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. There are no rules saying what can go in them, or how much nicotine they can contain. There are also no rules requiring labeling about the contents.
What's in the juice? Who knows what's in the juice? Could be anything.
Studies have found carcinogens, things like formaldehyde, in some vaping liquids. But even without that, nicotine on its own increases blood pressure, lowers the birth weight of babies, and damages the brains of teens. So for public health officials, vaping isn't a good tool for quitting. It merely extends nicotine addictions. But vaping proponents say e-cigarettes are a better alternative to the known carcinogens, particulates, and tar in tobacco smoke.
Everyone has a family member or a loved one or a friend who has suffered from a smoking-related illness or death.
Gregory Conley is the president of the American Vaping Association.
oftentimes they allow themselves to blame nicotine for those harms. But nicotine is just what creates the dependency. Smokers smoke for the nicotine, but they die from the tar.
He's upset that public health officials don't see e-cigarettes as an anti-smoking device.
So the idea that they can't recommend a smoker who has tried to quit with the patch, gum, lozenges, Chantix, etc., they can't recommend smokers pick up an e-cigarette?
And that brings us back to the debate on where people can legally use e-cigarettes. Conley's group believes allowing vaping indoors and in public places makes e-cigarettes an attractive alternative for smokers. Public health officials, like Sarah Cody, worry that public vaping makes the habit look cool to kids and young people.
Remember when you used to see famous movie stars smoking and they looked glamorous and fabulous and you wanted to be like them? Same kind of marketing tactics now used with e-cigarettes with no regulation.
Just like the image of Hemingway made smoking look appealing to Natasha Ernst, Cody says that by making vaping look glamorous, e-cigarette manufacturers are creating a whole new generation of customers addicted to their product. Back on the sun-filled San Jose patio, Natasha Ernst says she knows there's a debate about vaping in public.
When I'm out, I always make sure that I'm very discreet. I don't do anything that draws any type of attention to it because you need to be very polite. That's just part of being in society.
But as long as it's legal, Ernst doesn't plan to stop vaping in public. Earlier this month, a state Senate committee signed off on the idea of banning vaping wherever smoking is prohibited. The bill faces another hearing later this spring. In San Jose, I'm Leslie Griffey for Cross Currents.
Where do they go? Smoke rings I blow each night. Oh, where do they go?
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. While the acceptability of smoking and vaping in public is going through a transformation, public perception of other drugs is also changing in the other direction. Recreational marijuana is now legal in 3 states and decriminalized in many others, and psychedelic mushrooms are starting to be used for medical reasons. Some doctors are now using their main ingredient to treat anxiety and depression in cancer patients and also to help people overcome addiction. Author and journalist Michael Pollan usually writes about food, often about your more garden variety mushrooms. But in a recent New Yorker article, he writes about the history and the resurgence of this psychedelic research. He sat down with Leah Rose from the Upshot podcast to talk about what he calls the trip treatment.
Could you tell us a little bit about R. Gordon Wasson, who introduced magic mushrooms to the West, and about the woman who he learned about mushrooms from in Mexico?
Yeah, Maria Sabina. Well, there had always been rumors that Native Mexicans had a psychedelic drug that they used in their religious observances. And there had been tales of these magic mushrooms that had been bouncing around the ethnobotanical circles. There was a guy named R. Gordon Wasson who was actually a banker at J.P. Morgan in New York, very upstanding guy who was obsessed with mushrooms. He was an amateur mushroom hunter, mycologist, and he was married to a woman who was Russian, and she knew a lot about mushrooms, and Russians are passionate about mushrooms. And he invested a lot of resources tracking down these rumors, and he found this woman, a curandera, it's called. It's like a shaman or a healer, who in southern Mexico, I think in Oaxaca, who agreed to let him participate in a mushroom ceremony. Turns out they had been going on continually since the conquest. The conquistadors had tried to suppress mushroom worship because it was pagan. And she was persuaded to administer mushrooms to him in this all-night ceremony. And he has a mind-blowing experience. And he comes back and writes an article, 15-page article in Life magazine.
It just seems like such a big subject, and there's so much to write about and so many different avenues you could have gone down. How did you pare it down?
I wrote about this end-of-life anxiety trial because it's the most moving. I mean, you know, everyone is afraid of death. We all have existential distress. That's their name for the condition these people have, you know, to one degree or another. And talking to people as they face death is a very profound experience. And I focused on this one character who I never met, who died before I started this research. But I was able to recreate him on the page using his own words because he'd kept a wonderful journal of his experience, and interviewing his wife. And his wife generously gave me permission to have access to his the notes of his therapist. So I had two accounts of what was happening in that room. And when I read his account, I realized he was the one to organize this around and that this was the way to connect – to get people connected to the story. And indeed, you learn in the first line of the story that he does eventually die. So there's no suspense there. But the suspense is, how does he die? Does he die in a better way than he would have if he hadn't taken this drug? And the answer clearly for him was yes.
So after writing this article and researching it and talking to all the top researchers who are working in the psychedelic therapy field, were you at all curious to try psychedelics yourself?
Yeah, it definitely made me curious because I talked to so many patients and they had the most amazing experiences and they were life-changing. And then I think, well, do I want to change my life? And so I'm both curious and frightened of them because people also have these, you know, grueling, you know, trying experiences on these things. They can really bring up trauma. They can bring up, you know, all sorts of issues, and people see scary things, and the bad trip is a reality, and you never know. You're always tossing the dice. What was kind of appealing about doing it this way, which is to say in a guided psychedelic trip, as these patients do, is that there's someone there with you who understands what's going on and knows exactly what to say if you get into trouble. And that's very different than using these drugs recreationally, as we say, in that you can be kind of out there on a limb by yourself when bad things happen. So if it were possible to have one of these experiences in that kind of environment, which of course is not really possible unless you participate in one of these trials, I would be intensely interested to see what I could learn.
I found it really interesting how you described the room where the research takes place and, you know, how it was decorated. And I'm curious if you think that had any effect on the experiences that people had.
Without question. I mean, one of the really lessons of 60s research with psychedelics is that the physical setting and your mindset have a lot to do with what will happen. And that these drugs they're not predictable in their effects. They're unlike other kinds of drugs and that they're highly suggestible. And so, for example, if you're with a therapist who has Freudian tendencies, you will have Freudian insights. Hmm. And ditto if you have a Jungian therapist or a behavioral therapist. So the environment in which you do this and the person you're with has a big effect. And so they tried to set up the room so that it was as – living room-like as possible and not – it didn't feel medical. There was a comfortable couch and there were bookshelves and on the shelves were, you know, books of art and spirituality. And then, you know, part of the experience too is that you're not sitting up on that couch. You're lying down and you're wearing an eye shade or an eye mask and you're listening to music on headphones.
Can you tell us about some of those experiences that some of the patients had – and how they were actually able to wipe out something as big as existential panic?
The drug is psilocybin that I focused on, which is the ingredient in magic mushrooms. And it is a milder psychedelic than LSD. It doesn't last quite as long. The effects are not as intense. But nevertheless, it's still a pretty intense experience, especially at the doses that they were administering. And these were mostly people who had cancer diagnoses, some of whom were dying, some of whom were in remission and very terrified of a recurrence. And their anxiety about their cancer or their oncoming death was paralyzing their ability to function in the present. And You know, at one level, if you said to me, you know, you have a terminal diagnosis, do you want a trip now? You know, it seems like the last thing you'd want to do. But some of these people were in pretty desperate straits, and this offered some relief, and they tried it. And in many cases, it gave them incredible relief. Kind of mind-blowing, because only one experience would have this effect. And what would happen to people – I mean, people had very – everybody's trip is different. But the people who were grappling with death or cancer often had a kind of rehearsal of death. That was an important part of their journey. Some people described going up to a precipice and looking out over this great plane of consciousness, which they interpreted to mean this is life after I'm dead. This is where I will go. And somebody had an experience of she was zipping around as if in a video game, going all over the world, all over time, and then suddenly, boom, she comes smack up against the wall of a crematorium. She
said,
"Oh my God, this is my death." But she didn't have an experience of burning and or pain. But then from having had this freedom to move around, she found herself going into the soil and being taken up by the roots of trees and realizing, oh, that's what will happen to me. That seems okay. That seems fine. But having had that experience gave her a lot of equanimity about what was about to happen.
That's journalist and author Michael Pollan talking about his article, The Trip Treatment. That conversation is from the podcast, The Upshot with Leah Rose, engineered by Justin Richmond. You can find a link to Michael Pollan's article and listen to the full interview at theupshotpod.com. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Philip Greenleaf is a kind of musical everyman, a teacher, a composer, an improviser. He plays saxophone in 30 different Bay Area bands, everything from movie music to bebop to experimental art rock. For this episode of Bay Area Beats, Greenleaf talks about his latest project, Barbed Wire, a series of graphic scores that connect visual art and music, making Do Re Mi do some pretty wacky things.
It's a way of thinking about sound where I'm thinking about frequencies on the saxophone, generating frequencies rather than notes. Frequencies have more complex textures, right? And a note is supposed to have a nice, solid, fundamental, oh. When you start layering that with all sorts of, you know, some people call it noise, but it's really just a more complex web of frequencies that are happening. Improvised music, to me, it would seem to be the oldest music that's around, right? It must have been what people were doing long before anyone decided to say, no, there's one way I want you to do this, and this is how you do it. Let me think of a way to mark that so that you'll always know what I wanted you to do. So people have always had to make things up. But sometimes control is the word that comes up the most. Sometimes you want to control all those urges. And, Stravinsky said that we need restrictions to enjoy the freedom we have. And I think that's true. graphic scores in the way that I'm discussing them come out of, I think they started occurring in the 1940s, and they were just Xenakis and other composers were architects, really, really interesting history behind it. People who were architects and who imagined that these, you know, these visual systems could have a relationship with frequencies. I don't know if you know the story behind Xenakis, but he was a journeyman studying under a very famous architect. And he created all these drawings for this architect, and he liked them. But he said, well, these belong to me. You're working in my shop. So Xenakis just sort of brilliantly said, well, okay, I've signed those over to him as drawings for possible buildings, but what I'm going to do is ask musicians to play these drawings. You know, all scores are graphic scores, right? Every music composition is an attempt by the composer to come up with a system that allows the musician to look at it and say, oh, okay, I know what to do with this, right? And we say traditionally notated music is a system, but it's just a system of graphic information. It's graphic cues, and we've all agreed that there's meaning attached to these. What I like about graphic scores is that they're open to interpretation. Some composers are very, very, very specific about how to deal with the visual cues. In some of my works, I do, but in a lot of them, I don't, because I don't want any performance of the piece to sound the same way this twice, right? Let's see. Yeah, number three. It sort of looks like barbed wire that's been, you know, some of it's just lying there flat on the table, for example, and then maybe I just tied a bunch of knots in the wire, and then the barbed wire goes straight, and then I tie it, and then I wound up the wire into a bunch of loops, and then it goes off in another direction. Yeah, I kind of want you to go in a straight line here. Oh, but no, I want you to go off and get lost for a second and have an accident, then come back almost to the place where you were and keep traveling in that direction, but keep having little accidents or interruptions. And then, oh, make a big turn and end somewhere else. A variety of different players could play these scores together. You know, people playing any different instrument or a dancer. And what really is required is that you're a good listener. You know, the door's open. You can go anywhere. And I love that about what we're doing today. I love it that I might meet someone from Japan or another country with a totally different tuning system, totally different history of classical music, whatever that means to you, or folk music, whatever that means to you, and that we can get together and transcend boundaries of place and transcend boundaries of style and language and just play.
That piece was produced by KALW's Julie Kane. You can hear Philip Greenleaf perform his Barbed Wire series on May 19th at Berkeley Arts. Find the details at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. And if you've got an idea for a local musician we should talk to, email us at news@kalw.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter @KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Jeremy Dalmas, Jack Detch, Audrey Dilling, Rachel Dornhelm, Marcy Fraser, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Angela Johnston. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll visit a class that's helping people come to terms with their carnivorous diets.
And I was like, yeah, this is where we start out, is not having this giant aversion and horror about death. Because I eat meat, and I'm not going to pretend that someone didn't kill that animal for me.
Killing and eating animals. Tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music is by Oakland band Felsen, which is the German word for rock. That's exactly what they'll be doing on Friday at Oakland's First Fridays. First Fridays takes place all along Telegraph Avenue from West Grand to 27th Street, described as an immersive art community experience. Pedestrians take over the streets from 5 to 9:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Be brave, take a walk. Downtown, check reflection.